Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. My name is Josh. I'm an Orlando entrepreneur, and I travel around having conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and those who support and build the entrepreneurial community here in Orlando. I'm in the office of Joel Goldstein, and he is known as Mr. Checkout, right? Like, this is the name of your company. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Joel to the show. Joel,
thank you very much.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Joel Goldstein. And one thing that I did was when I was kind of coming up in as a kid, I was always kind of a terrible employee. So I always had a job. And you can see on my wall, you know, we have my Boston Globe bag from when I was like, I think I was 8 years old. I was a paper boy in Boston. And you know, I was always trying different things. I was a waiter. I was, you know, when you're a kid, you try everything when you're 13, 14. So I got to the point where I realized that I was a terrible employee, and there was just something coming out called eBay. And when eBay first got started, you know, it really was kind of a grassroots thing where nobody really knew what it was and everybody was really curious. But I was installing car stereos at the time at a, you know, at a shop, and I wasn't a very good employee there either. But I loved installing car stereos. I loved using my hands. I loved getting dirty. And I loved playing with all the different technology because it was changing so fast. So I used to go down to the swap shop down in South Florida. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I used to go there all the time.
Did you?
Yeah, I grew up
there. How funny is that? How great is that car collection?
It's awesome.
It's an amazing car collection.
Yeah.
But I used to go around the swap shop, and I noticed that a lot of people on their, you know, mats outside were selling amplifiers. And from working at the car place, I knew how much that cost. You know, they were hundreds of dollars. And for me, that was a lot of money. So I went up, I asked, how much is this? And she's like, $50, $60. You know, they start low.
Yeah.
So they started low. I negotiated lower. I bought, I think, two or three initially. And I went back and I sold them on eBay. And I remember they didn't even get to the end of the auction, you know, before somebody started making me offers. And I sold all of them. And this was back when, you know, car stereos were really hot and everybody was putting a big subwoofer in their trunk. And so I knew that there was a ton of audio stuff there. So I kept going back every weekend with my buddy. You know, I eventually got a little pull behind cart and I started stacking up amplifiers and car stereo items. And, you know, I turned it into an eBay business. But the problem is I ran out of inventory. I pretty much bought out the entire place after maybe 2-3 months. So, you know, I got into that problem where I needed an evergreen supply and there wasn't one there. You know, it just wasn't refilling fast enough. So by chance, I happened to be buying my dad some golf clubs. And I was at Edwin Watts. Are you familiar?
Yeah.
So I was at Edwin Watts. I was standing in line. I was buying, I think, a driver. I was buying a new driver. The guy in front of me was selling pretty much the exact same thing used back to the store. And I knew they had a used section. I didn't check it out, but I knew they had a used section. The guy was, you know, selling it for 20% of what I was paying for the new one. And I thought to myself, you know, they're pretty much exactly the same thing. You know, so I got up to the front. I asked to speak to the manager. I spoke to the manager, a really nice guy. And I said, you know, can I buy, you know, a couple clubs from you? Maybe I cost a little bit above to try to sell them. And he did it as a service so people can get out of their old clubs and into new clubs. So he didn't really care about making money. That wasn't a profit center for them. You know, so he gladly sold me some inventory. So I bought my dad the new club. I bought a bunch of used stuff, went on eBay, and I doubled and tripled my money.
Wow.
And I found an evergreen resource for that, you know, for that eBay store. So, you know, I took my bar mitzvah money. I went with my buddy who used to go around the swap shop with me. And we rented a U-Haul. I had the manager of the store call all the other Edwin Watts managers and tell them that this kid's coming with a bucket full of money, and he wants to buy your stuff. And so, you know, I did my research and I drove around the state in a U-Haul with my buddy, and we pretty much bought out the state of used golf clubs. And I rented a little warehouse and I turned it into a multi-million dollar business on eBay. And I sold that business. I sold the eBay business right before China got in and pretty much decimated everybody, because they were able to sell pretty much the same thing knockoff for nothing, and tanked it.
Wow.
So, you know, the guy that bought it still runs it today. He's happy with it. You know, it's a lifestyle business for him. But yeah, I got lucky very early, and that was kind of the start of my entrepreneurial journey.
So I have some questions. I used to walk around the swap shop with my grandmother, and we would buy stuff, and I was always buying baseball cards, Oakleys, mm-hmm. and some other things, and then I would sell them in school, right?
How funny is that?
Yeah, so swap shop, we probably ran into each other. But when you started selling amplifiers, you saw that there was an opportunity, and then you made a pivot into a new product, but you knew the system, you knew the process,
right.
You knew how to make it work.
You hit the nail on the head with process.
Right. So why don't you walk us through early stage process, mm-hmm. like as you were creating that, what did you learn about entrepreneurship from selling amps mm-hmm. to selling clubs? Like, what was a very strong learning lesson for you?
Well, the product didn't matter. That's what I learned. The product doesn't matter. It's customer acquisition. And, you know, I preach that constantly when I guest lecture. You know, it's all about customer acquisition and cost. So the way that you acquire customers on eBay, the cost was the auction fees and all the things on top of that. But the way that you acquired it was search engine optimization, before search engine optimization was actually a term. So I was able to optimize my product listings for what people were searching for. So I didn't necessarily say just the name of the club. You know, I also included search terms. So people were actually stumbling across it when they were typing it into Google or Yahoo or whatever the search engine was at the time, because you remember back then there were a million.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So let's just say for a golf club, mm-hmm. you know, you buy a golf club for how much?
A used one. $50.
$50. And you sell it for?
$125, $150.
How much time did you spend on each golf club writing the description, the pictures, like?
I paid my friends. I had like three or four friends that I paid, you know, I paid $10 an hour, I think, back then, which was good money.
Yeah.
I paid them to clean the club, take a picture of it, do the description, you know. So
you...
We used a lot of goof off.
Yeah. But you learned a few things about leveraging, you know, mm-hmm. other people's talents and skills, but you focused on buying in bulk and then
right.
and then selling. Mm-hmm. And then what was your profit in your pocket at the per club, or like
90%? It was, you know, almost 100%. Yeah. The costs were so negligible, you know, with the volume that we were doing, so you know.
So how old were you when you sold that Google business or the eBay business?
Yeah, it was right when I graduated high school. I don't know.
You just graduated high school and you sold an eBay business.
It was right after I graduated high school.
Are you allowed to say how much you sold it for?
I don't want to.
Okay.
it was enough.
Okay.
It was enough.
And so then you graduated high school. What did life look like for a guy who just sold a business?
Yeah.
As a, you know, just getting out of high school.
I put it all away. So I pretty much put 100% of it away. You know, I the only thing I really splurged on was I bought a dream car. I bought a Prowler. You know, I had a bright orange Plymouth Prowler throughout my days after high school, which I bought cheap and I sold for more.
Nice.
So you know, I kind of had that trend throughout all my cars, but you know, I never buy new and I always sell it for more than I buy it for. But yeah, I pretty much put all of it away, which was, you know, great decision. And you know, it allows me to have the flexibility in my lifestyle and my choices, you know, when it comes to my life today. And that's really, you know, what I attribute everything to. And it was all from, you know, really good advice from my friends and family. And, you know, I grew up with, you know, an entrepreneur as a father, an entrepreneur as a grandfather. You know, we're all terrible employees.
Yeah. Well, it's good for you to really know that. Like, you know, I said that one time. I was like, you know what? I don't make the best, you know, employee unless mm-hmm. I'm at an entrepreneurial place. And I got negative response from that. And I was like, well, it, It's true.
You got to know yourself.
Yeah, you got to know yourself. So what does it look like to be a bad employee and a good entrepreneur? What are some of the characteristics that you've seen?
Well, they're exactly the same. I mean, it's making fast decisions, not, you know, when you're an employee, you can be an amazing employee, do one thing very well consistently, you know, provide a great level of service and a consistent, you know, output. But as an entrepreneur, my mind doesn't just stick to one thing very well. It's how does this one thing that I'm doing affect other things, and how can I change those other things to make my thing a moot point? So I want to get rid of my job, you know, as an entrepreneur. I want to eliminate as many roadblocks as I can so I can automate the entire process, still provide great service, but pretty much eliminate all the middle. And, you know, when you're an employee, you're a cog in the machine. And when you're an entrepreneur, your brain is looking to eliminate as many cogs as possible. So, you know, it's just,
yeah, you know. That's amazing. So, okay, we're out of high school. You bought your dream car. You bought it cheap, and you're now rolling around. Now, what was your next couple steps in your world? Your father's entrepreneur, your grandfather's entrepreneur. Where did that lead you?
I started a million businesses. You know, I started a failed business called SnapSale, where I went to, because I grew up in South Florida, so I went to a lot of people that were selling very expensive Mercedes and Porsches and Ferraris, and I'm like, listen, I know eBay. You know, let me sell your car on eBay. I'll, you know, give me a commission on it. I'll sell it. You know, it was just such a pain to deal with these people, you know, that it was not worth the money.
Yeah.
And I think I sold one Mercedes and it didn't sell for very much. So, you know, that was a failed business. But I got into Forex trading. I got into day trading a little bit because I like the numbers. I like that aspect of it. And, you know, I kind of continued that throughout college. But I had a million businesses. One that was really cool, which I don't know if I should talk about.
Well, now you've got to, right?
Yeah, I have to now. I'll allude to it. So I was at UCF for undergrad, and it was to the point where, you know, I was starting to go out, I was starting to socialize, and which I didn't do much in high school because I was working so much. So, you know, I had a girlfriend, I was working so much, I didn't really socialize. I never went to clubs or anything like that, but I started going to a few clubs in college, and I was into programming. I was really interested in programming, but I never went to classes or anything like that. But there was a lot with hacking back then. Like, that was the cool term, was hacking. And it was actually at a time where you could hack and you could brute force passwords. And there was a lot of cool tools online that, you know, you can download, you can play with, and you can try. And so I tried a few of these tools, and I accessed a few mainframes for public universities in the area that had email lists.
Yeah.
So I quickly acquired the email for pretty much every student in Central Florida. And I turned that into a marketing company for clubs and for club promoters, where they rented the lists, you know, they purchased access to the list, where I sent an email blast out for them. And, you know, I grew that business, but I hated it. I hated dealing with club promoters. The personalities didn't mesh with mine. So I sold that business on Craigslist.
Oh, gosh.
And I just wanted out of it.
Yeah.
And I sold the business on Craigslist. The people who bought it from me, they were club promoters down in Miami. They crashed that business within a month, month and a half.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I had a couple friends still that were dealing with them. And they're like, yeah, they don't pick up the phone. And that's the number one thing I've seen consistently. If you want to be successful in anything, and just pick up the phone. All you have to do is call somebody. Nobody calls anybody anymore.
Nobody calls anyone.
Just call somebody and ask them for help. That's all you have to do, and you can be successful in whatever you need.
Wow. All right, so you sold a company. You sold an eBay company, and then you sold a company on Craigslist.
I was moving up in the world.
Yeah, you're rocking it. So where does that lead you? Now, this whole time, your dad's in business, and
yep.
What's your father's business?
My dad ran Mr. Checkout, what I run today. Mr. Checkout started, he ran it since, he started it 89, but he did before then. He used to be a distributor when I was growing up. And he bought things at wholesale price. He put it in our garage, you know, in Boston. Yeah. Then he drove around in his minivan and he brought it into the stores, merchandised it. And, you know, he did that throughout my childhood. But back in the 80s, there was a big downturn in the economy, big crisis, and he started training other people on how to be a distributor. So he flew around the country. He started training all these people to set up their routes. He hired some trainers. They trained people to set up routes. And he quickly grew the entire country for these guys that were working out of their house, pretty much, that were bringing product into these convenience stores, gas stations, truck stops. And that's really where kind of he sat when we were in South Florida. You know, he was working out of the house. He was picking up the phone when people called him. He was selling the list of those distributors for a couple $100. And, you know, it was a great business for him. You know, it was a lifestyle business. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to grow up with him, you know, around the house all the time. You know, I listened to him pretty much every day of my life growing up on the phone. And, I always knew that I wanted to take over the business. Just because, you know, I love the industry. I grew up knowing it. I love the idea of a legacy business, a family business. And that's really kind of where I wanted my life to be, was now that I have two kids, I want to be a stay-at-home dad, ideally, you know, but, you know, I have a team and I want to keep this business running. So, you know, I turned it into a lifestyle business, you could say, but it's a great company, and I automated it, I streamlined it. We're at 6 times what my dad was doing, and, you know, with half the spend, a quarter of the spend. You know.
That's awesome. So you mentioned lifestyle business versus what? What would be the other side of a business? Like,
I guess the other side of being an entrepreneur and having a lifestyle business would be to, you know, have a job.
Yeah.
So, you probably know a lot of entrepreneurs that are, you know, hustlers, you know, every single day.
Every day.
Pounding it. I did that for a while. You know, I love it. And when you have an idea, you just sprint towards the finish line. You know, you got the goals, that's great, but it's not great when you have a family and when you have, my goal is to be the best dad I can be and best husband I can be. And I want to, the one tangible for that is time,
yeah.
You know, and spending quality time, not being on your phone, not being on your computer. We don't have TV at the house, you know. We don't have TV. We have a movie theater, but, you know, that's upstairs in a locked room that kids never see. You know, it's we don't have a TV accessible. So they get one, not they, my 2.5-year-old gets one show a day on our laptop. He likes to watch Elmo.
Nice.
You know, so I believe that there's a good aspect to it, but too much TV is bad, just in general. You know, but yeah, so my lifestyle business is something that I control my time. You know, we do a lot of vacations. We do a lot of time together. That's what we find as our tangible value.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. So with your lifestyle business, your father was doing this. How did you get involved and now run it?
Yeah. So I worked with him as his marketing arm, you could say, for a long time because, you know, I loved website design. I still do. I love SEO. I love marketing. I love all the internet-based stuff because it's, you can go by the numbers. It's analytical. You get fast response. You know, you see the result of what you're doing. So I was doing that for him for years, pretty much ever since he had a website. And when I kind of came on, it was because he's like, listen, I want to retire. You know, I don't want to work anymore. And so I was at a point where I'm like, I don't really want to, you know, take over the business right now. But, you know, it was either he shut down the business or I bought it from him. So I bought it from him. And he still works in it. You know, he still does some of the stuff helping out. But, you know, I run the day-to-day. And that's kind of, it was one of those things where, you know, it wasn't the ideal time for me, but there's never an ideal time. And so I said, this is what I want for my life. And I jumped in head first.
Right on. So what is Mr. Checkout today? Like, what has it evolved into? And what is your core, your business?
yeah, it's a lot different than it was. So I realized that our core competency was we had the ability to bring a new product to market faster and more efficiently than any other path to market that existed. So if you have a new product, you can go to trade shows to get into retail. I'm saying in-store retail, not online. In-store retail, you got to go to trade shows. You got to do it by boots on the ground. You got to do a lot of legwork to get it into retail. And if you wanted to get into Target or Walmart or any of the big box stores, they didn't want to touch you until you were in smaller retail around the country. They wanted proven product. So we have these group of distributors who we've now grown into 900 distributors and about 200 wholesalers around the country. And we have these boots on the ground, and they want product that isn't with the big distributors, isn't in the big box retailers. So we had that, you know, that give and take. So we provided a path to market through automating and systemizing and making processes that were efficient and trackable, scalable, that brought these products to market through these distributors in a actualized way where we can track that and then bring them future opportunities relatively quickly compared to, you know, going to a trade show and waiting for people to call you back, yeah. or driving around in your van all day.
So you guys help bring product to market, but mm-hmm. you do it in a way that's much faster. You can validate products, you know, really quickly because of all the boots on the ground.
Exactly.
How do you find the cool products to bring to market?
That's an awesome question. We don't do any outbound advertising and marketing. We do one thing, and that's retargeting, because it's effective.
Okay.
But
what is retargeting? For those listening
of course.
Who don't know that.
So retargeting is those pesky ads that you get whenever you go to a website and then you go to your Facebook or you go to Instagram or Google and they go, hey, remember that site you visited? Come back and check us out. So retargeting is advertising to people that have already visited you. So, all of our traffic, pretty much 95% of our traffic is organic, which means that it comes to us from people searching online and finding us through Google, it was pretty much all through Google. But that's how we get our traffic. And if somebody finds us online, chances are that they have something that we offer that they need. So we use retargeting. The cost of acquisition is a lot higher, but our ROI is there. We get about 30 to 50 submissions a day for a new product. And I'll take you through it, after we're done. But we get about 30 to 50 submissions a day. And I have somebody that we hire full time that pretty much combs through those submissions to make sure that the product is retail ready. And if it is, they send us product. We check it out. We taste it. We try it.
You play with it.
We play with it.
Yeah.
And we make sure that it's something that, we can work with. And we now own 13 industry associations with over 150,000 retail members. So we have a number of paths to market besides just our distributors going to convenience stores that, really has diversified our ability to bring a product to market. So, going back to my goal, my mission statement, if you could say, we want to make the most efficient path to market for a product into retail that we can do. And I think we've achieved it, but you're never perfect and I'm never happy. So,
so 50 a day coming through saying, hey, here's my product. Mm-hmm. It's a new iPhone case. It's a new toy. It's a new this or that. Out of all the things that you've seen from you doing this for years and years and years with you and your dad, what is the coolest product that you've ever seen come across your plate? Or the craziest?
I don't want to go into craziest.
Okay, so we won't go.
we have a closet full of the craziest things that we can't talk about on your podcast. The coolest thing, I think, was it was so overly engineered. It was a golf club that shot a blank 22 round that fired a piston that shot a golf ball for people that, couldn't swing a club anymore. So it was pretty much a golf club gun.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can still play golf. I still have it at home. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. But you know how much work it is to engineer something like that. Just the milling and the
oh my God, the guy must have spent $1 million on this thing. And you know, I doubt he sold five. You know, but that was the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Oh, wow. Really cool. So I guess if someone's in the audience and they have a product, what is some advice that you have?
Yeah.
To take a product from idea, so they maybe created a prototype, and let's just say they're retail ready. What are some advice that you have to getting that product on the shelves in stores?
Yeah, the biggest thing is knowing your numbers. Logistics is pretty much where all the money goes, is getting the product from your warehouse to the store shelves. There's a lot of fees and there's a lot of incremental costs there that a lot of people don't account for when they're first coming to market. And don't count on the scale to drive your cost down. Know your numbers going into it. Have that investment so that your cost can be at a place where it's accessible to independent retailers, because that's going to be your first stop on the chain. You want to have proven in-store sales before you try to go out to a trade show to get more sales. You want to have those people that you can point to saying it's selling really well, it's selling so many units a day, it's turning once a week. You want to have that vernacular down before you try to build upon it. So Amazon's great, but the things online don't translate to in-store. Somebody walking down an aisle isn't going to be the same shopper as somebody typing in something on Amazon. So you want to have those in-store numbers when you're trying to build that business.
Wow. So you mentioned something. You said don't count on scale to drive down your costs. I think a lot of people, they think it's once I hit scale or once I hit a certain amount of numbers, my cost will go down and I become more profitable.
Right.
Why is that a trap?
Yeah. So by the time you get to that scale, there are so many other incremental costs that come in that steal your any profit that you would have made. So I'll give you an example. When you're working with an independent distributor, typically it's around 20 to 30% that you're paying the distributor as a margin to take the product and put it on shelf. So when you're working with a larger distributor, it usually drops down to 10, 12%. But they're going to charge you a warehousing fee. They're going to charge you a marketing fee to market the product in their catalog to their customers. Then you're going to need to pay their salespeople an incentive bonus to sell the product. You're going to have to pay the Publix or whatever large retailer that picks it up. You're going to have to pay them promotions. You're going to have to pay them stocking fees. There's a lot of other things that take that 8%, 18%, and just steal it from you. So if you're counting on your cost to drop by 20-30%. The logistics are going to eat that up along the way. And as you scale, the costs go up. They don't go down necessarily. So it's a lot cheaper for you to make a product in your garage, drive it into a store yourself, and put it on the shelf. And as you jump from rung to rung, the costs don't go down. They increase with the more people you add to the process. People add costs. So you want to make sure that there's enough of a margin in it from the get-go that you're paid first.
What does it mean to where you just mentioned make sure you get paid first, right? Like, explain that, because we had a conversation before we hit record about paying yourself first.
Yeah, it's incredibly important to make sure that you cover your costs, and that includes your salary. Always pay yourself a salary, whether that's $5 an hour or $100 an hour. You want to make sure that your costs are covered. And I think a big mistake that a lot of entrepreneurs make is that I'm going to build this to a place where I'm going to get acquired and then I'm going to be a multimillionaire. That's great, but how are you going to pay your bills? I'm going to take out of my savings account. We both know that a lot of people get to that point where you get to a really good scale. You're doing really well. Your business is boiling. And then a larger competitor takes pretty much everything, and you're struggling to hold on to something. There's a lot of stories like that. you got to pay your bills, you got to pay yourself, and keep your savings account a savings account. You know, it's great to invest in yourself, but you want to make sure you pay yourself first.
And you mentioned, you know, multiple times on this show and even before we hit record about knowing your numbers.
Yeah.
So in terms of product, right, getting, you know, creating a product, getting it to the marketplace, selling it, getting it in the customer's hands, what are some of the major numbers that you should pay attention to for the product creators out there?
Yeah. So the biggest mistake that I made, I talk to 10 entrepreneurs a day, yeah, you know, about this. And so when I say know your numbers, I mean it, because I'd say maybe 10% of them actually know their numbers, where you want to make sure that everybody's making money. You know, nobody believes in your product. Nobody cares about your product at all. You know, your product is just another number to them. They want to make money for their kids to go to college. They want to make money so they can have a boat. You know, everybody wants to make money. And if you don't provide a way that shows other people along the way that are helping you how they can make money or get rich or, you know, increase their business or cash in on a missed opportunity, then it's your mistake. So knowing those numbers means that you need to know the margins that are expected, and you need to know that you want to be above those margins. You don't want to be in the middle. You don't want to be another product. You want to be a breakaway product. You want to be something that, you know, somebody's excited to push. And you got to know that you're not the first person with that idea. You know, I speak to so many companies that they're the only person that are doing this in this space, when I've spoken to 5 people that week that are doing the exact same thing. And I don't care about one business to another. You know, I tell them this. You know, it's not really the business that I'm excited about. It's, I want to see what the product does when it's on the shelf. I don't care how innovative you are, or revolutionary, or that your product is so much better quality than, you know, the Hershey's out there. You know, you're not going to win on that, because when you're walking by the shelf, you're not going to be able to say my product is, you know, sourced from the source and all those keywords. You know, you want to make sure that the product moves on its own volition. And you don't know that until you know your in-store numbers, meaning your turn rate and meaning your, you know, products per day. You know, all those numbers are very important, and you don't know until you know.
So you help product creators do this, because a lot of them have no clue. So you help them.
If they don't have a clue, they're not at a point where they're speaking to me.
Okay.
So,
you know, so what's the perfect client for you?
A perfect client for me has about 50 to 100 stores under their belt. You know, they're doing well in their local area or region. They're maybe working with a couple local distributors, and they're ready to scale nationally. That's what we have the ability to do. We have the ability to take a local or regional product national a lot faster than any other means. And, you know, there's no other network like ours that does that, because you can't, you know, go out there and train people with boots on the ground now and fly around the country and train them to open routes. You know, so, you know, we've been in business for 30 years, and, you know, we really rely on those relationships and that ability to scale a product to really launch product. And, you know, we're working with Kraft Heinz, we're working with Maybelline, we're working with, you know, we were the first to market with 5-Hour Energy, with Blue Electronic Cigarettes. You know, we're working with Juul right now, this billion-dollar behemoth that grew up overnight from nothing. Those kind of companies that come to market through the product, the categories that Walmart doesn't want to touch, that's how we bring a product to market.
That's pretty awesome. So what question should I be asking that I didn't ask?
I love that question, and there's never a good answer for it, you know. But I think we've covered a lot of it. The big thing is, if you want to be successful as an entrepreneur, the best thing is to pick up the phone, because absolutely nobody does. Speak to the person who answers the phone like they're the president of the company. I hate that. When, you know, my team and I were very tight. We're an incredibly tight-knit group. And if somebody treats one of my team members bad, happens constantly. You know, they think that the president's not listening, or, you know, the owner's not listening. I know absolutely every conversation because, you know, we talk about it during lunch. You know, we talk about, you know, this person who called and, you know, was rude, or, you know, just, you have to treat everybody with respect. Pick up the phone, know your numbers, and know that you're pushing an opportunity that, you know, isn't special, but you have a better solution because it's going to make the other person money. You know, that's really, you have to keep that in mind. Nobody believes in your product. Nobody cares about your product. They care about themselves. And just knowing that going in is what's going to make you competitive.
Got it. So you mentioned the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
You mentioned South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And here in Orlando. Why Orlando for you?
Oh, I love Central Florida. So, you know, I had a brief stint up in Boston where, you know, I went to Harvard for, you know, a master's program. But when I was in South Florida, I hated the materialism of South Florida, where, you know, I knew a lot of friends. I went to private school growing up. I was very fortunate that way. A lot of my friends that were, grew up in private school, their parents had a lot of money. They didn't turn out well. You know, they turned out very spoiled, and they turned out very entitled, and they turned out with, you know, drug problems and a number of other things, where I learned money is not the goal. Money can be a path to freedom of time, which was my goal, but, you know, having the biggest pot at the end of the day is not a goal that you should have. You should be able, in my opinion, you should work to free your time up as much as possible. So I learned that from South Florida, from seeing a lot of friends, kind of their parents and their families go through that. And when my girlfriend at the time went to UCF, I came up here. I loved that this was a younger area and that there was so much to do, and that, you know, I loved the area around UCF. And I loved that it was very open to new ideas. And so I went here as an undergrad, and, you know, I bought a house and kind of planted my stake, and, you know, I've grown in the area ever since. And, you know, I started going to meetups back in the day, and I absolutely loved the entrepreneur community that I found through those initial meetups. And, you know, I've grown into the I've tried BNI, I've tried all the other kind of groups, because I love that kind of camaraderie that a lot of people that are, you know, working to make themselves better and their businesses better rely on each other and help build each other up. And that's what I absolutely love about this area.
That's awesome. So for people listening in, if they want to connect with you, learn more about you and your business, where can people go to find you?
Yeah, I have joelgoldstein.com. You know, always own your own name.com, or else somebody else will. So I have joelgoldstein.com. That's probably the best way.
Okay. So we'll include that in the links below.
Mm-hmm.
So people listening in. Any parting advice to entrepreneurs out there who are interested in the product space, retail space? Any parting last piece of advice for them?
No, I'd imagine that if you're listening, you're probably part of the Central Florida community. If you're not, you should be. And the best part about the Central Florida community that I found, and I've immersed myself in it, is that everybody is incredibly accessible if you have good intentions and mm-hmm. you make the effort to get them on the phone. So you're not alone. You have an amazing network that you may not have tapped into, but don't be afraid to call and ask for help. You know, the biggest thing that somebody that's achieved anything that they want to do is reach down and help other people that are maybe not following in their footsteps, but, you know, coming up. And, you know, that's really one of the biggest things that I love about Central Florida.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Joel, thank you for your time, your wisdom, your advice to the community, and for being a part of
Central Florida. Thank you for asking me.
Yep. So, ladies and gentlemen, listening into this interview, I hope you've enjoyed it. My ask to you is that you reach out to our guests and you say, hey, heard you on the show. What you said was really impactful. You know, thank you for, you know, for the wisdom and advice that you shared. And, you know, that's my ask for you guys, is to reach out to our guests and let them know how wonderful they are, and lift them up. So until then, everyone, thank you for listening into the Orlando Entrepreneurs Show. We hope you enjoyed it, and we will talk to you all on the next show. Goodbye, everyone. See you, Joel.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You can also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.